You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
We don't really know what, where, or how the original Christmas happened. Maybe April? Certainly not on December 24th and 25th. That was the day adopted by early Christians because Romans were already celebrating Mithra's birthday and Sol Invictus, the festival of the unconquered sun. For Luke, the family lived in Nazareth and traveled to Bethlehem, where there was no place at the inn. Shepherds and angels were in attendance. For Matthew, the family lived in Bethlehem. Herod and the wise men played big parts. And of course, there's no story at all in Paul, Mark, or John. But what most people aren't aware of is all the other gospels out there that didn't make the cut. Why didn't they make the cut? Well, some for theological reasons, some for political reasons, but they were dropped in the 3rd and 4th centuries when the church was trying to develop an identity and, in modern terms, spin the information. Subsequently, the Gospel of Thomas, the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, and the book from which our reading is taken today, the Infancy Gospel of James, were dropped. Especially at this time of year, it's a shame to have excluded the Infancy Gospel of James, because it's a source of a lot of the images we take for granted as part of the Christmas story. This Infancy Gospel was probably written late in the 2nd or into the early 3rd century, and definitely wasn't written by the same author or authors that the biblical James was written by. The funny thing is, much of the information we claim to know about Joseph and his family, and a lot of the art depicting the story, like Mary riding a donkey, is drawn from this jettisoned gospel. There are no details in our biblical stories about Joseph's age or children, but guess where you will find them? Yep, in the Infancy Gospel of James. The birth takes place in a cave, and there are other details about midwives and Joseph's children that are in the back of our minds, but aren't normally the subject of Christmas sermons. We're reading just a short excerpt for this morning, not because I'm going to refer to it specifically in the message, but just as another example of how wide the net is from which we gather the images that mean the most to us at Christmas time.
Our words of wisdom today are from the Infancy Gospel of James, chapter 17, verses 10 and 11, and chapter 18, verses 1 and 2. When they came to the middle of the journey, Mary said to him,
"Joseph, take me off the donkey," the child pushing from within me to let him come out.
So he took her off the donkey and said to her, "Where will I take you and shelter you in your awkwardness? This area is a desert."
And he found a cave and led her there and stationed his sons to watch her while he went to find a Hebrew midwife in the land of Bethlehem.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
About 15 years ago, a guy from Connecticut was on vacation in Arizona and showed up at church. He introduced himself to me as Steve Burt, a professor and pastor who was a fan of Living the Questions. Little did I know that he was also a gifted writer who was on the road to winning multiple awards, including a Bram Stoker Award for his young adult fiction and other books. I encourage you to check out his library of available books online. Over the years, I've read several stories to you from his book, A Christmas Dozen, including Perfect, Just Perfect, and last year, The Blessing Bell. The story I'm reading to you this morning, I read to you almost 10 years ago and remains one of my favorites. I hope you'll sit back, close your eyes, and be transported with me back to Steve Burt's vision of Thumb Island, Connecticut, in 1909. My name is Elvira Whipple, and I've lived on the thumb my whole life. I'm 94 and not real healthy, so I thought I'd tell why the Congregational Church manger scene has more than the usual Bible animals in it. This one has two papier-mâché elephants. Christmas Eve 1909, I was a week shy of turning 10. It snowed all day, so we had a foot of new snow atop a foot of old. My father was a deacon at Thumb Island Congregational Church, and my mother sang in the choir. I was so eager to get to the 8 o'clock service of hymns and candles, I could hardly eat supper. As most folks know, Thumb Island, or the Thumb, as most people call it, isn't an island at all. It's a village that occupies a small peninsula, water on its south, east, and west, and it juts into Fisher's Island Sound like a swelled thumb. The coastal railway crosses at the north end, where it connects to the mainland. So it looks on a map as if a thumb's been lopped off and stitched back on. As far back as I can remember, locals have simply called it the Thumb. Back when I was growing up, we had 5 churches on the Thumb: Congregational, Baptist, Episcopal, Roman Catholic, and Shiloh. I never really understood the differences. I can see now that much of what I learned was incorrect. What I thought my parents and other adults were saying was this: the Episcopalians were kissing cousins to the Church of England. You didn't have to be wealthy to belong, but it helped. And it helped if you could trace your lineage. My father said they made too much of a show of their religion when they worshiped. I later learned that they were very liturgical. The Baptists were similar to us Congregationalists, except they dunked people to baptize them. We sprinkled ours. Baptist prayers were longer, too. The Catholics were people we were supposed to avoid. Many were from Europe, fishermen and their families who didn't speak good English, my parents said. They made the sign of the cross when they passed their own church. On the other hand, Episcopalians, Baptists, and Congregationalists made a point of crossing the street to avoid meeting the Catholic priest. For reasons I didn't understand, Catholicism was the farthest thing from Protestantism. Still, we bought fish from the Catholics, and to me, it tasted the same as Protestant caught fish. I didn't know if Shiloh was a Black Baptist or a Black Methodist church, but it was near the railroad tracks. Its members were mostly the families of railroad porters or ship's stewards. Some folks called it Shiloh Church, but most said the colored church. I had no idea what Shilohs believed, but I loved to go by their church in summer when the doors and windows were open so I could listen to them singing. If there was anything like an ecumenical movement back in 1909, it never got across the tracks from the mainland and onto the Thumb. I thought we'd never leave for church that Christmas Eve, but finally we did. We walked through the deep snow, and I arrived out of breath. My mother went to the balcony to join the choir, and my father walked to the pulpit to talk with the minister about communion. Mr. Moody's organ prelude filled the church. I sat back and inhaled the smells of the church as if they were my lifeblood. The slight mustiness, the polished pews, the candles, the heat from the downstairs wood furnace rising up through the floor registers. When I opened my eyes and looked behind me at the clock hung from the back balcony, it said 8:01. The organ prelude ended and the congregation hushed for the opening anthem. A loud voice shattered the silence. "Friends, we need your help!" I spun around and looked back towards the door that led from the foyer into the sanctuary. Directly under the clock stood a Black man in a suit, his hands stretched in front of him as if he were preparing to direct a choir. I recognized him as one of the railroad porters. No one moved. A wagon's stuck on the tracks. We can't get it off. We all stared at him. This was the first time any black person had ever set foot in our church. Please, he pleaded. It's a big circus wagon. The church emptied, everyone following him to the grade crossing. There were no passenger trains on Christmas Eve, but there might be a freight. Most nights, we could count on one around 11:30. At the grade crossing, we found a huge wagon, like one I'd seen for transporting prisoners, tipped over on its side. This one, though, was bright red with gold trim. It was longer than two stagecoaches and built like a small railroad boxcar. And across its ends, it said, Barnum and Bailey, the greatest show on earth. The wagon had small slits for windows on either end. A man stood at one of the windows, talking into it, cooing softly, the way you'd calm a baby. A team of four brown and white draft horses stood there, still hitched. Four or five black men held lanterns. The Shilohs had arrived first since their church was only 100 yards from the crossing. After a minute or two, two small crowds arrived, Episcopalians and Baptists, led by a different black man from Shiloh. Right behind the black man was the Baptist minister in his white shirt, black suit, and overcoat, followed by the Episcopal rector, who still had his black robe on, which showed beneath his coat. I could tell from the way the snow was tramped down and from the sweat on their faces that the Shiloh people had been struggling a while with the wagon. What happened? My father asked, and the man who had been cooing into the wagon stepped toward him. I was driving this team from Boston to New York City for Barnum and Bailey, but the storm caught me. The horses were worn out, so I headed for Thumb Island. I hit the tracks and a little off square, and when the wagon tilted, the elephants must have shifted their weight inside, so the wagon tipped. Elephants, my father said. As the adults talked, I sneaked up to the wagon's slitted window. A black girl named Hannah, about my age, stood beside me with a lantern, and we peered in. I had never seen an elephant before, only pictures. The mother lay on her side, and the flank that showed looked dusty. It rose and fell like a swelling sea. Her head was massive, and under it I could see a crumpled ear, as big as my coat if I spread it on the ground. Look at that eye, Hannah said. It's beautiful, like a cow eye. What she said was true. The huge eye had the same foolish, gentle look as a cow staring over a fence, waiting to be handed a handful of grass. The baby elephant stayed by its mother, not nursing, just standing. They stared up at us, and the mother seemed to sigh. I expected the smell of manure to drift out of the barred window, but what I breathed in was more the scent of a baby after a bath, a fresh bread smell. I wanted to touch them, to learn what their hide felt like, to see if it felt the way our school teacher, Miss Harms, said an elephant's hide felt, not rough and dry, but soft and silky. Hey, look, someone said, and Hannah and I stepped back. There came the Catholics, their young, handsome, newly arrived black-haired priest in his robes, leading the procession. What's wrong? He asked. Two elephants in the wagon, my father said. And we can't get them out? The priest answered. The doors are on either side of the wagon, the driver said, so one's down against the track and the other faces straight up. Can't we tip it back up? The priest asked. Nah, the wagon driver said, shaking his head. A bunch of us tried, but it's not just the weight of the wagon. You've got a 5-ton elephant plus the baby. Every time we try to right it, the elephants get nervous and shift their weight, forcing us back down. How about getting them out first, then moving it, our church's minister said. The Episcopal rector thought that was a good idea and suggested chopping a hole and removing one entire end of the wagon. but the wagon driver reminded us that the wagon had been reinforced with iron bars. After all, he said, it's designed to hold elephants. The mother trumpeted, and we all jumped back. Excuse me, said the black man who had burst into our church. The land is flat here at the grade crossing, which is why we're always trying to lift the wagon up. But what if we skid the wagon along on top of the tracks, like hauling a boat? Look, it's only 200 yards to the cove beach, where the track runs on top of the rock pile. The beach is lower than the track, so we can tip the wagon down instead of up, and it'd be a lot easier. Everyone stared at the man, then looked to the wagon driver, who shrugged his shoulders. Worth a try, the driver said, but the snow's pretty deep, and we'll need a wider path than a train. He pointed at the foot of new snow that had accumulated on the track, and then at the 2 feet of old and new snow alongside it. We'll have to clear it, the priest said flatly. He made a megaphone with his hands and announced, Friends, we must clear a wide path to the beach so we can drag the wagon there. Hurry! In no time, we had 100 or more people all carrying shovels, ropes, and chains. Two oxen appeared along with the horses. By 10:15, we had a wide path cleared to the cove, and the oxen and horses had been hooked up. Folks tied on more ropes, and every person there grabbed on like it was a tug of war at the county fair. And we pulled, all of us. My Lord, did we pull. The wagon came by inches and feet, slow because we had to keep changing positions. Hannah and I had pulled it first, until my father gave us each a lantern and told us to stand on that rock trestle in case we had to signal an approaching freight train coming from Mystic with a snowplow on its nose. Two other girls took lanterns down the track to the east and stood watch there. Hannah's and my teeth chattered as we stood on the rock trestle that had been built to get a train across the tidal cove. While we shivered, everyone else heaved and sweated. We could see them wiping their foreheads with their sleeves. After we'd been out there a while, Hannah said, Vira, you think we'll beat the train? God only knows, I said, which felt true. We gazed down the tracks toward the wagon. The piled up snow on either side of the tracks made it look like a tunnel with no roof. Dozens and dozens of lanterns sat like luminaria atop the banked white snow, lighting the way, lovelier than any Christmas candlelight service I'd ever seen. Down along the track, groaning and sweating, inching the wagon toward us to save those lovely, lovely elephants, we could see black folks and white folks, horses and oxen, Catholics and Protestants, the sprinkled and the dunked, all working side by side. Lordy, I thought, what God wouldn't give to have me in Hannah's view. As soon as I thought it, I realized God was right there seeing it, an arm around each of us. A little past 11:30, we finally got the wagon positioned on the track above the beach. The team drivers set up their horses and oxen on the south side of the tracks while anyone not handling animals went to the north. People were to pull until the wagon tipped and started sliding downhill, at which time the animals would pull the opposite way and serve as a counterweight to slow the slide. The plan worked perfectly. Almost. We pulled, the wagon shifted balance, then it slid, yanking horses and oxen 10 feet back, clump! The wagon crashed onto the frozen beach and all four wheels snapped like soda crackers. But the wagon stayed upright. The terrified elephants trumpeted and banged against the wagon's walls. Then they were silent, and we all hushed. I looked down. Hannah was clutching my hand. Lord, bless these elephants, she whispered. Amen, I said. The wagon driver held up a lantern and peered in. They're okay, he said. We all cheered, and people began shaking hands and hugging, forgetting they were white and black.
Catholic and Protestant. You'd have thought a hometown boy had just won a big race or a war had ended. Some people sat in the snow and wept. I don't know if the tears had to do with elephants or exhaustion or both, or if they were about seeing folks together like that. Then a familiar voice yelled, "It's Christmas Day!" It was my father holding up his pocket watch and pointing at it. A minute after midnight, I never saw him so excited. Someone started in with, "O come all ye faithful." And before long, everyone was singing. And that's what we were doing 5 minutes later when the freight roared through. We were all singing Christmas carols and smiling. The engineer, seeing what looked like a tunnel of lights, must have thought this was a Christmas celebration for him. He cut his speed in half, waved and grinned, and yelled Merry Christmas from his cab like Santa Claus from his sleigh as the noisy locomotive severed the thumb on its way east. During the night, the driver moved the elephants to a horse shed behind Shiloh Church, where people came by to visit them all Christmas Day. It was strange to see folks from everywhere lined up at the Shiloh Church to catch a glimpse of the Thumb Island elephants. And they did feel smooth and silky, Hannah and I found out. The day after Christmas, a replacement wagon showed up and the elephants set off again on their journey. So, there's the story and there's your answer. Now you know why the Thumb's Congregational Church manger scene has two gray papier-mâché elephants that are about 85 years old. I made the dark-skinned one, and my lifelong best friend, Hannah, made the light-skinned one. Or maybe it was the other way around. Doesn't matter, really.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.